like to know more about. I chose the topic, To Fall in Love with Seeing, was my first painting instructor, and that's how he talked about the process of becoming an artist. And I do believe that, and I think that the idea of seeing and really seeing something is something that very few of us do, and that as an artist that's your task. In a sense, it's to unlearn the things you know about seeing. And so what I want to talk to you about today is that idea of how we learn to see and how we learn to perceive the world. And I have an article by Annie Dillard that I will be passing out when we're done. And I like to start this by quoting her, and she says that vision is a deliberate gift. And I think that's a wonderful way to think about how we perceive the world as a gift to us. And she, in the article, I hope you have a chance to read it, because she talks about these little gems of things, these little things we see around us at any one time as little pennies, little things that are there for us to find. In and of themselves, they aren't particularly valuable, but they add up to be worth a great deal. And she says, no, that's up the way. That's all right. Anyway, as she says, the world is studded with these gifts of vision. They are there for any who would take time to really look. It is a dire poverty when one is so malnourished and fatigued you can't stoop for a penny. But if you cultivate a healthy poverty and simplicity so that finding a penny will literally make your day, and since the world is then planted in pennies, you well in your poverty have bought a lifetime of days. It is that simple. What you see is what you get. So what I want to do is turn on some slides. The word seeing is often used to mean understanding, in the sense of I see what you mean, or I see what it is you're talking about. We aren't really talking about vision in that sense, but it's a clue to us, a language clue, how important seeing is to the process of memory and to the process of knowing anything in the world. So the question becomes, how do we perceive the world? Is that sense of vision merely a mechanical process? Is it an innate process that we're all born with? Or is it something that we've learned to do? And then most importantly, how does an individual's perception shape meaning? How does what an artist or anything around us that we see, how do the perceptions that you take in, that I take in, shape meaning? How do we take that raw material, those raw materials, and fit them into our own experience? And what the arts are trying to do is they're trying to control our sensation. They're trying to only show us certain things, so you will end up feeling something from the sensations that you get. That's why a theater is dark and usually quiet. That's why art galleries and museums have white, stark walls. It's so the sensation that you receive is confined to the artwork being presented to you. It's often why new architecture is very, very stark and simple. The sensation that you are receiving is being controlled. That emptiness or control helps to make you receptive. This is an installation of a current show by a woman named Barbara Kruger. She's done everything. She's stenciled things on the floors, on the walls, on the ceiling. She's controlling the entire environment to make you receptive, to make you grant what they call in theater that willing suspension of disbelief. How am I going to convince you of what I have to talk about? And what's going on is there's some sort of implied contract with you in the audience to tell you what it is you're supposed to pay attention to. Visual art, though, is a little different than theater in some ways. It's not asking you to totally put everything aside and live in a new world, but because it's asking you for a little different sense of cooperation. It's usually only involves a single maker. If you go to a gallery or museum, that single maker is probably an old, dead, white guy, and you, as the implied audience, are making some sort of contract between you, and in this case Leonardo da Vinci, that he has got something to tell you and you have something to receive. Visual art is not a performing art, and most of the artistic decisions that you see were made somewhere out of your sight and hearing. Until very recently, all visual art has really prided itself on how autonomous it is, that an artist can always just go off in the studio and make whatever they want, in a way that points out how different it is than theater, because there are people in theater will argue a play is not art until there is an audience. There has to be the audience, and the actors have to be there to make it art. You could get into a big argument, is the Mona Lisa art if no one ever went to see it? But again, it is a contract between you and the artist. You are responsible on many levels for making the meaning of the Mona Lisa. Because although the Mona Lisa sits there and exists as a very famous, discrete object, the meanings associated with it may change, even though the Mona Lisa itself has looked this way for the last 400 years. The meanings, we can't make any assumptions that the Mona Lisa means to us what it meant to either Da Vinci or the people who saw it at the time. Ooh, in this dark room, we'll have a hard time seeing this slide. In this light room, I'm afraid. There are many similarities among the art forms in terms of perception, but for our purposes today, I think the closest ones are between visual art and music. And mainly that's because of the fact that both visual art and music are highly abstract. No matter what it is you are talking about, this is an artist named Kandinsky. This is from about the turn of the century. Kandinsky was very interested in music and the spiritual in art, and he came up with forms, these abstracted forms, and this happens to even be called a nocturne, like a piece of music. And he was talking about the inner harmony in that are the same between music and visual art. So there have been many artists and musicians who have talked back and forth about the same issues in terms of perception. If you think about it, even a realistic painting is highly abstracted. This is a self-portrait by a very famous German expressionist artist named Max Beckmann from about 1920. It's very recognizable as a human form, but he has abstracted it a great deal. He has flattened out the forms. He has done all kinds of things. I think it's important to remember, we get, I always say we're locked into our 15th century eyes. We all like to look at the world of art as if we are dealing with the Mona Lisa in that sort of what we call naturalistic or realistic. Even the Mona Lisa is highly abstract. So again, when you look at work, keep in mind what choices the artist has made about what to include. It's also very important to remember that even a photograph, which we have all these things in English, we say, oh, you know, photos don't lie. That's not true. A photograph is also a visual convention. A photograph is no more realistic than a painting. And there's been a lot of study done about photographs and why we inherently believe that a photograph is more realistic. If you think about it, this is a street scene in San Francisco. This is not how it ever really looked there. It's flat. It's two-dimensional of a three-dimensional scene. It is a visual convention. One very interesting way to think about the visual conventions that are in photography is to know that the principle photography is grounded upon comes down to us from the time of the Renaissance. Da Vinci, Michelangelo, all the Renaissance artists knew the principle of photography, which is the camera. The camera, what camera means in Italian is dark room. If we kept this room, we could get this room very, very dark, and we put a little pinhole by the window, just a very small hole, the scene outside would appear on this screen upside down. Artists knew that since the Renaissance. That's just, it's a physical fact that happens. And artists knew that, and it meant dark room, and artists used it to make landscapes and some things like that. But it wasn't until scientifically it was figured out how to put that image onto a plate to fix it that it became practical to be used. And there's a man in Chicago, at the University of Chicago, whose theory on this is also that the time that photography became accepted as the visual convention was when they finally figured out how to make a lens that aped 15th century painting that look like Renaissance painting. Because just think of the kinds of lenses you can have in photography. You can make things look like anything you want. You can have fisheye lenses, you can have all kinds of lenses. It wasn't until they figured out the lens that gave us the same kind of use of perspective and things as we see in 15th century painting, that it was acceptable as looking realistic. That's very important to know, because this looks realistic to us as Westerners. It's not realistic to many other groups of people around the world who learn to see in different ways. So what we're going to talk about is how our idea, we learned to see this way, we learned to think of this as realistic, but there are many, many other ways to see the world and to perceive the world. The thing we have to keep in mind is that sight is not our first sense as a human being. We first, in utero, have the sense of touch, taste, smell, and hearing. And they are fairly well developed in utero. They've done a lot of experiments. Many doctors say they think babies can perceive differences in dark and light before they're born, but it's very rudimentary. That's not a very developed thing. And as a matter of fact, when they observe babies, it's really about a month before babies can stand much light at all. Their eyes, it hurts their eyes. They're not used to that. So what they have figured out is that babies have developed their interface with the world before sight develops. They have developed through a sense of touch, and they have accumulated experience about the physical world before they can see the physical world. And that's very important to keep in mind. What they do is, once a baby, after about the age of a month, starts to begin that process of learning to see, think of all the things they have to learn. They have to learn about depth and space and distance and color. There are all kinds of things they have to learn to do. And the thing that's really fascinating when you start to think about that process as babies learn that, is that the interconnection of touch and sight are the strongest two senses. And what they have discovered is that that connection is vital for the formation of our memory. Because what they, and if you think about that, this is true. We all know what this is. This is a boot, right? And we really know what it is. We know how it, what shape it is. And a lot of the way we know what shape it is by feeling it. Because if you look at it, this is a boot, and this is a boot, and this is a boot, and this is a boot. It looks totally different. The visual image you receive is completely different, and it's constantly changing as you move around a building, as you move around a person, as you move around a house. The visual clues you get of this chair look totally different, yet you know it's a chair. A lot of the way you know it is by the touch and the feel. And one of the experiments they've done on that is, it's very interesting that they make these special glasses that when you put them on, it flips your vision. Everything is upside down. And they put those on people, and of course people are, you know, very disoriented. And they discovered two things. One is, if you wear the glasses long enough, your brain will flip the image and you'll see everything right side up again, even when you have the glasses on. If you take the glasses off, everything's upside down until your brain figures out and turns it again. But they discovered they can do the process faster. They put the glasses on you, and you look at this, and the boot appears to you upside down. If they let you touch it, your vision flips, and you see it as right side up without that time. So there is obviously, vision is a very complex sense. It has to do with how something feels and how you figure out what something looks like by how it feels. So there's a lot going on there that we don't really know about. The other thing they have discovered is that vision takes up, in terms of our brain, takes about 90% of the cerebral cortex. Some part of the cerebral cortex has something to do with vision. It's incredibly complicated, and they still don't really know exactly how it works. What they do know is that the sensation, as we see here, enters the eye through the lens, hits the retina where it registers upside down, but what happens from there is purely conjecture, and it's something that people have been thinking about and trying to figure out for years, for centuries, as a matter of fact. What we do know scientifically is that our eyes are equipped to only pick up about 30% of the spectrum of light. Visible light is only about 30% of a very large spectrum that goes from x-rays to radio waves. It's all electromagnetic things. The ancient Greeks had a theory. They're the first people that we have written theories about how we see, and they had some, they were very distrustful of the senses because they had observed some things by looking around. If you put a stick in water, it looks like it takes a jog. Things like this. And so they decided because of that that human senses were inherently untrustworthy, that you couldn't trust anything you saw with your eyes, that seeing was not believing, that your mind, your reason, had to take care of everything for you. And so they were very distrustful of the surface appearance of things. So when you look at their work, their things, they were very interested in the mind and showing you everything that was there and not paying attention to sort of the optical tricks. And one of the things, optical tricks, that we use in art is that if somebody stands in profile, we know they have two legs or whatever. We don't have to see that. They're showing us everything that's there because they're so distrustful in the sense of that trickery of the eye. So when you look at their work, they are trying to show you everything that they know is there through their reason. By people like Da Vinci, he's already experimenting and trying to figure out how the eye works. He was, if you may know, he was the first artist that we know of who got into dissection. He really knew what an eye looked like inside. It was against the law. He was, but he did a lot of anatomical things. He did drawings of the eye, and he had a theory that rays went out from the eye to the object and came back. What's interesting is that it sounds very silly to us now, but there are people these days say that that was probably, that's not exactly wrong, that there was, he had some ideas about it that were very interesting. The other thing to keep in mind when you're talking, this is sort of the 1400s, the late 15th century when Da Vinci was working, was also the age of discovery. It's when Columbus came to Western Hemisphere. What's very interesting when you see the information that comes back to Europe is how the Europeans saw what they expected to see, not what was really here. And again, it's that idea that we only see what we've been trained to see. We don't know something unless we've been trained to see it. Contemporary thought that explains how we see talks about that perception is not merely a sensory picking up from something in front of us, but instead is a very selective process. It's very intricate. One of the things that we know is, through all kinds of scientific investigation, is that there are many more things around us going on visually than we let in, than we perceive. Part of that is because there's too much. If we had to pay attention and attend to everything in our surroundings, we'd be so busy looking, we wouldn't have time to do anything else. So, and again, our eyes are being very selective. They're picking things out. And what the idea is in how we perceive the world is that there, what we're seeing is some sort of a gestalt, some sort of form. And what our eyes are really doing is seeing visual experience as a total unified configuration. In other words, we have little templates we fit everything into, squares, circles, triangles, various shapes. We fit them all into those. We don't look at the intricacies of what is really there. What happens is that our brain provides what's called closure. You don't have to see very much of something to know what it is. What is that? Can you see what that is? It's a student drawing, but what's the drawing of? Can
you
tell? A bicycle wheel. We don't have to have very much visual information to know that. And what that tells you in all kinds of ways is that our intelligence and our memory work together with our visual perception. And the thing about that is we have learned these categories and concepts, and even though we have a category called chair, even though when you look at that chair from any different angle or that boot from any different angle, it looks different, it still fits in the category. That's the reason it's so hard to draw. Because what you try to draw is the concept, not what is actually in front of you. That's why it's so hard to draw a table that looks flat, because you know that the top of the table is square. That's what you want to draw. When you look at a table in perspective, it's not square at all. It's not anywhere close to square. And yet, your mind has fitted into this category. That's a very useful thing, and it's very evolutionarily important that we have learned to do that. The reason for it is, if you didn't have that ability to fit things into these categories, you couldn't drive a car, for one thing. Because when you're driving a car, you can't be thinking all the time, now let me think, I'm 200 feet from the other car, and I'm, 2 feet on this, I'm going so fast. You can't do that. You have to fit all these things into the categories. If something's this size, it's that far away. You don't even think about it. So if you didn't have that ability, there are many things in the world you couldn't do. The problem is, to become an artist, you have to throw those categories out and look at how things really look to you. You can't rely on those categories any longer. So what, in a sense, drawing is it's a challenge to all our visual assumptions that we have. You should never accept the visual conventions laid out by your culture and experience if you really want to draw something. So what an artist, in this case Raphael, is doing, he's going, obviously this is a study, he's going to be doing a painting of a woman sewing, and he's really having to look at what do the hands actually do. What is the actual posture of the body? It's not about the idea of sewing, it's he's trying to explore all kinds of things to tell you. He's trying not to accept the visual conventions of his day. So the question becomes, do we all see the same thing when we go to the Grand Canyon, for example? And my contention, and I think many people would say that, no, we don't. That what we see in front of this scene or any other is completely influenced not only by what's there, but by the viewer's intelligence, memory, race, cultural group, and amount of training. Something different will be taken from that scene by any number of people. Different things will be picked out. Different things will be abstracted. All kinds of things will happen because of that. This is a Chinese work, the looking at a tree in this case. This does not look like a naturalistic tree to Western eyes. This absolutely fits into the visual conventions of the Chinese world. The question that's very interesting to me, if I looked out the window and I was Chinese, is this indeed what I would see? Probably fairly close, in the sense that in my work, when I look out, I always feel I am being very true to what I see, and other people will go, I never saw that color there, I never saw that, but I feel very true to what I see, and I think that's true of most artists. So in a sense, what you are being given in a very lucky way when you look at a work of art is a window on how someone else sees the world. And it's very interesting to think how somebody, what kind of training they have, what kind of training you have, how are they seeing the world, and how are they presenting it to us? What is being shown to us? What kind of memories did the person have who made this? Another thing that we know is that people who grow up in a rural environment, such as Holden Village, or this happens to be Montana, are very much more observant than city dwellers. They know much more about the world that they live in. They know more about the color. They know more about space. They know more about the shapes of things and how things look. If you grow up in this kind of environment, as opposed to someone who grows up in an urban environment. It's not because there's less to look at here. In many ways, it's because there's too much to look at here. There's too much going on. You cannot walk down the street and attend to everything that you see in an urban environment. You need to use that category of your brain, that part of your brain that puts things into categories, that navigates by landmarks, because otherwise you would probably go crazy. You could not keep track of it at all. So what drawing is trying to do, in a sense, it's a very careful investigation by the artist of the way that the artist sees and experiences the surroundings, and the consideration of the many ways to put this down on paper. This is a very careful look at this bunny rabbit by a contemporary artist, because the inborn capacity that we all have to understand through the eyes has been put to sleep. And what artists often are trying to do is to reawaken that, is to tell us that there is more to a bunny rabbit There is more to the color of a white bunny rabbit than we have thought before. In a sense, drawing is the most universal activity for organizing what we see. This is from the cave at Lascaux in France. The visual grammar that we have that allows these simple marks to stand for a complex visual information is already in all our brains. We know this is thousands and thousands and thousands of years old. We know exactly what it is. We have the categories. And what drawing is, it's the most universal way. It's the easiest way for us to get some of these ideas about the world across to other people. So I think probably the most important thing to remember is, and to think about, is that vision itself is not a mechanical recording of the elements in front of us, but rather an apprehension of the significant structural patterns of the world. It's telling us about the pattern. When we look at this, is this sign as tall as the buildings in downtown St. Paul? No, of course not. There's no one above a very young age in Western society who would think that. But again, you have learned that. You have learned that something that's very large, that overlaps something else, is in front. The Annie Dillard article I have talks about that a great deal. She talks about people who are blind and are given sight, and how they don't understand that at all. And that's something that has to be learned. And my favorite example of this is my daughter Claire, when she was about two and a half, went on an airplane to visit her grandma with her father, and she was very taken with it. She's very interested in the whole idea of airplanes and going places, and she's quite visually acute, and so she knows, she learned the Northwest logo, she knew all about this. And so one day, not long after that, a couple months maybe, we were driving along near the airport, and a jet flew over, and it was low, and it looked like, you know, it was probably about this big, but it was low enough she could see the Northwest logo on it. So she said, "Oh, Mom," she said, "look," she said, "that's almost like the airplane I went to Grandma's on." And I said, "You're right, Claire, that's really good." And I said, "But, you know, it's almost like it. Don't you think it's just like it?" And she said, "Oh, no, Mom," she said, "I could never, the plane I went on to Grandma's was much bigger." And I said, "Well, Claire, that airplane is far away. That it really is a big airplane, just like you went on." She says, "Oh, no, I could never fit in an airplane that size." It just made her furious. And I realized she literally did not know. And what's interesting since, and she now has it figured out, but every once in a while she'll check, she'll say, "That's not really little, it's far away, right?" And she's working that out. And what's interesting is if you talk to children along the way, you realize that they do have to learn all that. They don't understand that. That is a learned part of our life. And so I think it's real important for all of us to keep that in mind. That
so it sounds like little cute things that kids say sound cute, but in fact it's a learning process oftentimes that they're going through. It's a very serious, deliberate learning process.
She didn't think it was funny at all. I mean, she was just irate that anyone would think, you know, she could fit in a 3-inch long airplane. You know? She was mad about that for quite a while. So again, seeing becomes a very personal experience. It's conditioned by thought process, memory, and associations, leading to wildly different interpretations of any subject. There are no rules that govern this inquiry, but there are a wealth of past experiences and past examples from every field of human experience. And there are ways of looking methodically at how it can be used to raise the level at which we see and then transcribe that experience. And I think that is the artist's task, is to reawaken us to the fact that there are many other things going on. Individual artists and cultures all form the world in their own image. This is a 13th century Madonna, and we learn many things about how the world looked in two people in the 13th century. If you notice, it doesn't use perspective. Ever since the Renaissance, we have been convinced that perspective is more realistic. That means lines converge in the distance, the railroad tracks come to a point, the road disappears on the horizon. This news is absolutely the opposite.
She's being tipped forward and presented to us. She's very close to us. She's also much larger. There are all kinds of things. Look at the size here of the monk. How small he is as a person compared to the Madonna. We are being told about her importance. We are being told all kinds of things that we would not be told in something that was very naturalistic. We know about things we know about the 13th century, the way the kind of things, clues we have from artwork tell us that symbol is much more important than the realistic surface, the scientific view of things that we now look at. This is a 18th century American folk art piece. Again, it's the same. What's interesting is it's an untrained artist, but it's exactly the same reverse perspective that we saw in the 13th century Madonna piece. Again, this is about these people, about their possessions and things like that, and it's not about realism in the sense that we talk about realism. We are being told things about these people and how they are being presented. This is a 20th century piece. I think we're being told something about this artist's view of the 20th century as perhaps a fairly lonely and alienated place to live. The artist is never a mechanical recording device. Artistic representation is not a tedious transcription of the accidental appearance, detail by detail. It tells us all kinds of other things. The artist here is interested in giving a sense of movement. The artist in this case, this is from New Guinea, is interested in saying something about a spirit of an ancestor. The kind of seeing that leads to the creation of great art is an outgrowth of the seeing of everyday life. The artist conceiving as an instrument of life, a refined way of understanding who and where we are. Okay, that's all I have prepared. So if you have any questions or things that you'd like to ask about or think about.
Well, this is really enlightening for me. I don't believe I've ever had an introduction to art, and this has been very helpful.
I do have any of you who are interested. I do have
Shall I turn the overhead off?
Yeah, you just turn it off. I do have some copies of the Annie Dillard, and I think it's a wonderful article to read here. I'm asking for them back at some point. If, because I don't want to keep, you know, making more and more copies, but it's a beautiful article, and she really does talk a lot about seeing the world. And,
thank you. One of the things that came to mind when you were talking about artists creating something of their own image, I mean, what they are able to perceive. It struck me how, of course, biblical description of our Creator making us in His own image, that came to mind. I thought, wow, that, what does that say? You know, that's something to ponder for a while.
Well, I think it's an interesting, really an interesting question. It's one I've thought too, because I think that we have as a society, maybe it's a human, we have a fear of image in some ways. There are a lot of, like in the Islamic tradition, you may not make images of the human. And you really even shouldn't do the animal world because that's God's business. And as a human, you really shouldn't mess around with something that God has done. I think that if you look in the Judeo-Christian tradition, the whole idea of the fear of image, the graven image, you shouldn't make, you shouldn't worship images, that there is this idea of photographs or images, they shouldn't be torn up, they shouldn't be, it steals, there are many cultures that believe that to take someone's image steals their soul. I think the image, or even the Pygmalion myth, you know, to take something that's inanimate and by making, you can breathe life into it, or Frankenstein. You know, there are a lot of people who say that Mary Shelley's story is really the idea of art making something real, but it becomes a monster that you shouldn't fool around with images. So I think we have a love-hate relationship with the idea of image, and that it's usurping somebody's power to make an image, maybe. So I love someone to do research into that, because I think it's a very interesting question.
On the other hand, I think it's a pretty common understanding that we are co-creators, you know, made to the only life known on Earth to be able to co-create with our Creator. And so I think artists are safe, from that standpoint, but it is an interesting.
Well, I'm not even sure. I mean, on some levels, as an artist, and I think many artists would agree, you're creating, but it's in a sense, it's a different creation. What it is it's taking. It's just filter. It feels more like filtering than it feels like creating, in a sense, because you are taking these perceptions and these sensations, and you're coming out with something new, and. And maybe even not new, you know, the same topics have been done over and over and over again. And it maybe looks a little different because I have different memory and different experience. And I might see the world a little differently, but I don't think it's a... it's more synthesis in some ways than creation.
What's harder, learning to perceive those images, give up, like you said, find freedom, from the acquired perceptions to see what is actually there, or the technical part of it, of art, where you actually go to work to put something either on campus or in some other structure.
Oh, good. Or just, I think maybe just even in the resource center. If I don't see you, you can just leave them in there.
Good.
Uh-huh. Bye.
I have a lot.
The technical side, I mean...
The technical is not the hard part.
I'm getting that impression from you.
No, anyone... I mean, I teach drawing all the time. That's
what
I spend most of my time doing. Anyone who can sign their name has enough hand-eye coordination. It's not that.
Huh.
It's all this.
Yeah. And I think that's what I've learned from this presentation.
Yeah. And it takes time to learn to do that, and I feel like I'm always learning.
Sure.
I mean, that's what I'm doing here. I've decided I'm going to do the whole time is just draw, because it does take a lot. But look how long it takes to learn to walk or read or talk. You know, I mean, in some ways, as adults think, oh, gee, I don't know how to do it right away, when, gosh, you don't learn another language. It's just a different way, but, you know, it's an eye training. It's not a, I mean, this stuff. Anybody can draw, if you're willing to spend the time.
So
and it's the looking. It's not the. It's not the drawing part. I mean, I do think certain people, the looking is easier. I mean, there are visual learners and there are auditory learners and there are kinesthetic learners, and I suspect an auditory learner would take a much longer time to learn. But yeah, it's anybody could learn to draw. It's
you
really not even
sound
a talent
like a teacher
thing.
There, you know.
It's true though. It is true. It's not, you know, that I mean, in some ways that's the biggest thing to fight, is that it's this inborn talent and only certain people can learn.
And you're saying that's something of a myth?
Oh yeah, totally a myth.
Huh.
Very few people are willing to spend just like very few people are willing to spend the time to learn Spanish or French or whatever.
That's certainly true. But it seems like there are those who are willing to put the hard work into it and are good, and then there are those who just are cut above, you know, that are the exceptional, the natural born, this and that.
Well, to a certain extent, but I have my painting teacher, drawing teacher from college. When I talked to him years after I graduated, and he said that, I don't know, after 20-some years of teaching, he had learned that the people who came in with the real raw innate ability were never the ones, or rarely the ones who went on and did anything. It was the people who were willing to spend the time. That too much of that sort of raw...
They can get by, huh?
They get by, and then they don't ever go anywhere with it.
Yeah.
They don't have... It's too easy.
Yeah.
I mean, you hear that about athletes. I think it's the
sure.
same.
Sure, music is that way as
well. Or music, yeah. There are certain people that... It's like it comes real easily, and they never go beyond a certain point, so... I think it's... Plus, it's fun. It's fun to do.
This was very helpful to me. Thank you.
Oh, good.
It was fun. It was fun hearing you, too.